And here's your prescription.
I know just the pharmacy to get this filled.
Who are you?
A pharmacy benefit manager. A middleman your insurer uses to decide which medicines you can get, what you pay, and sometimes even which pharmacy you should go to.
Why can't I go to a pharmacy in my neighborhood?
Because I make more money when you go to a pharmacy I own.
No one should stand between you and your medicine. Visit phrma.org/middleman to learn more. Paid for by Pharma.
We're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror. Hey, will you shut up?
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
Thank you, Lee. Quickly off the top before we get stuck into it. If I would have told you at halftime of the 2017 National Championship game, that the quarterback who just got benched would be about to start a Super Bowl as the favorite, by the way, against the guy who may end up as the best quarterback of all time.
You would have had to also explain to me that Patrick Mahomes at this point was going to be the best quarterback of all time.
Yeah.
Which, perpetual
500 team in Texas Tech.
Yeah. I wasn't like a hater of his. I liked him. He was a really good college quarterback, but I don't know that I expected this out of either of them. But yeah, I think it's really cool that Jalen Hurts has gotten this good. And I have to admit that I didn't see it coming because he was just limited as a passing quarterback in college. He was limited. And he
still think he kind of is, but we'll come back to that Sunday night.
He's gotten better at it, though. And I don't really think it matters.
Of course.
There's this interesting discussion happens all the time where it's like, all right, is it him or is it the context? If you have the best offensive line in the NFL and you get Devontae Smith and you get A.J. Brown, then who cares if it's the supporting cast or the quarterback? Like, results are results, baby. That's what you got to do.
Yeah, I'm excited for the Super Bowl. I think it's interesting. I do think there's a reality where it's a whooping, but I do hope it is a good game.
In what direction?
The Chiefs. There is a reality where Spags with 2 weeks to game plan for Jalen Hurts, and they just really neuter them, and they win. I have American dollars on an alt line Chiefs minus 12. I don't think that is the most likely outcome of the game. I do not think that's the most likely outcome of the game, but I do think it's fucking insane that like the bet splits are on the Eagles, at least early money, that everything is on the Eagles. Like, it's crazy how many people are like really sure the Eagles are going to win this game.
Just saying.
I think the Chiefs win this game either way.
4 double-digit sack getters on the Philadelphia defense. But Richard and Steven, let's...
Just to close this loop, are we now in hindsight saying that like the Tua swap was wrong ultimately hasty?
No.
Okay.
No. All right.
Like,
I mean, remember we watched that game together. It was not working that day.
That's true.
Life just happens funny sometimes, and things work out in a certain way, and Jalen Hurts
then
is in the Super Bowl.
You end up on the Dolphins.
Let's go back, though, to Jalen Hurts' alma mater. We've got some news of the week. He graduated from Alabama. That's his alma mater.
Yeah, he graduated.
So two coordinator changes this week at the what is no longer the preeminent program in college football, but, you know, what is – number two, I would say, with the Alabama Crimson Tide. Tommy
His
Reese.
Words not mine.
Richard, a team's won the last two national titles. I don't know what you want me to say.
Crawling under my desk.
It's not a point of offense. It's just they've won the last two national titles. What do you want me to say?
Why don't you tell them that?
It's not me who tells them that. It's the play that tells you that. But I think that Nick Saban would like to get back to that preeminence. And so two new coordinators here. Tommy Rees will run the offense by way of Notre Dame. Kevin Steele will run the defense, most recently by way of Miami, I believe, though everything that happened at Miami in the last year kind of becomes a black hole at some point. Look, people love Bama coordinator Minutiae. Like, I don't think that either of these were overwhelmingly popular hires on the internet, but convince me that I should feel differently about what's going to happen with Alabama in 2023 because of either of these compared to if they'd hired Grubb, the Washington offensive coordinator, or if they'd found a non-Kevin Steele defensive coordinator.
First of all, Minutiae. I think that Bama, I don't know what Alabama is going to look like on offense. I don't think anybody knows what Alabama's going to look like offense. First of all, tell me who's playing quarterback. That's the first question you got to answer. I think that we also are not all the way sure what a full complement Tommy Rees offense looks like, or a full power, I should say, Tommy Rees offense looks like. I think Tommy Rees, for the most part, played with the hand he was dealt last season. They had a fine quarterback situation to bad, great running back, tremendous tight ends, no wide receiver of any note, in my opinion. So they did what they could do with that complement of talent, clearly got better as the season got on, and you saw it. Now, look, I have my own opinions about whether Alabama should switch it back or try to bring it back somewhere near man ball on the spectrum, given what Georgia has done with two tight end set man ball. So we'll see. I don't know if Tommy Rees is going to bring that to Alabama, because I don't know if that's what Alabama's capable of doing or even wants to do. I'm sure Tommy Rees has plenty of ideas about the offense he'd like to run as a former quarterback. So this could be third era Saban, the swan song third era of offense, or it could just be continuing on like we're going with some subtle tweaks.
Let's go with point something else. So if not third, then maybe 2.7 or something like that. So let's all calm down a little bit.
And Godfrey, Kevin Steele coming around the defense. I mean, that's cool because, like, you know, I don't think he's going to succeed in pulling off a coup at this job. So you can trust him to just come and recruit and coach defense. And is this his like fifth, sixth go around at Alabama? How many times is he at?
This is third.
My favorite thing about Steele is that you can insert any meme you want to. You can do Auburn like coup. You can do Clemson got rolled by Dane in the Orange Bowl. You can do his Baylor head coaching tenure. Like Kevin Steele is really an interchangeable meme. He was an available defensive coordinator. I said this, and it was not received well, that post Kirby Smart and through the Pete Golding era, you will see literal statistical diminishing returns because of the era of football we're in, and that will not be received at all by Alabama fans or really college football at large. We are changing eras, and we are changing the way defense is considered successful or unsuccessful. And Alabama, by virtue of its own success in a different time when we were running different offenses, like Alabama's offense was very different. You're not going to see halcyon days of Kirby Smart back there. So Kevin Steele is fine and should acquit himself well. As we walk into the offseason hand in hand and ask large questions, Alex, I am fascinated as to what is going on in Coral Gables. Now, I get it. You're going to leave usually for Alabama. When the job title's the same, you're going to leave X job for Alabama in the college world.
Yes.
Usually.
Well, not all the time.
Usually.
Not all the time in Alabama.
Usually. Right. So,
where the fuck is Dan?
I'm just really curious what is going on.
Where is Dan?
Coral Gables.
Good question. Godfrey, one thing that was floating around, and I mean floating around sort of in the nebulous, thinly sourced internet rumor mill way, so just understand what I'm talking about, was that Nick might have wanted old friend Jeremy Pruitt to come and do this job, but that... I don't think
that was a nebulous internet.
Yeah, I think you should go to splitzoneduo.com today and become a patron, because we talked about this on the Patreon show last week, Alex. There's nothing nebulous about it. There were conversations between Nick Saban and Greg Sankey, and we've been dancing around this for a long time. I think Sankey dodged a significant bullet, and I am of the church of Greg Sankey is not nearly as smart as everyone wants you to think. However, I think Greg Sankey is, what was that F for, that you think he is that smart?
No, I think that we, and this is a quick aside because we have this conversation a lot. I think that I don't think Greg Sankey is the wartime consigliere in the way that Mike Slive was or needed to be.
Correct. Yeah.
And I think that makes him different. I don't necessarily think that makes him a worse or better commissioner than Mike Slive.
I totally agree with that statement. I just don't understand the fawning media attention that he gets for being some sort of tactical genius. You were born on third, champ.
They're adding Oklahoma and Texas.
Okay.
Godfrey, what I wanted to finish up, the thing that I want to imply was that I'm not clear about, was that, so obviously Nick's interested in this because of the things you guys discussed and because Jeremy Pruitt has a really good defensive track record, but that this was like a kiboshed by the league office, like you just can't do it, man, situation. Are you a believer in that?
I'm a believer in that the league office did not want Jeremy Pruitt. I'm a knower that the league office tried to keep Hugh Freeze away from coordinator positions as much as possible. Although going back, and I'm talking about, this is not current Hugh Freeze, obviously. This is like pre-Liberty job Hugh Freeze. Freeze himself and CAA trumped up a lot of the eligibility he had in a lot of those jobs. But yeah, they don't want someone engaged in litigation and NCAA enforcement issues and an ongoing COI, I think, or did it go to appeals? Like, they don't want that person scheming against that program at arguably the biggest brand in the entire league. I think that's pretty obvious for everyone involved. Now, what I was trying to say was I don't think Sankey's going to claim a win here, that he talked Saban down or told him no, because if that were to get back to Saban, I think thunder and lightning would rain down on Birmingham, because there are entities way more powerful than the league office.
Sure.
Richard got a big laugh out of this, but like, I do equate it to states' rights. I do equate it to a decentralized government. Like, the SEC privatized everything because they want to be as small as possible to afford its members, you know, its constituency, the most amount of money and authority. The problem is you have to keep all those superpowers in alignment. Look, we're all dancing around the fact is like the SEC is either going to have to come out and say there are going to be guardrails on who you can hire or not. This like gentle prodding and wagging your finger at Nick Saban, you're going to end up with one less finger.
Two pieces of college football journalism that I wanted to shout this week that I had quick impressions on before we get to conference reviews. One by Richard's colleague Ross Dellinger at Sports Illustrated, a detailed breakdown of why Oklahoma and Texas cannot get out of the Big 12 a year ahead of time. For now, even though they want to go and the Big 12 wants them to go, it's TV. Specifically to get to the dynamic here that's described in detail in this story, it is that Fox, which controls much of the Big 12, but none of the SEC, is not stoked about losing an extra year of Texas and Oklahoma games that would be on Fox. But if they left, that would go over to ESPN and would be out of the Big 12's Fox broadcast deal orbit. Excuse me. And I think that is telling about who really owns college football at this point. It's been signed over and it is no longer your favorite school that actually controls what's happening here.
I don't know.
Unmistakable impression that I got was that Fox and ESPN are calling the shots.
I don't think Fox and ESPN are calling the shots. I think Fox and ESPN are partners with these leagues and they can't come to an agreement.
Richard, who pays the most money? Right. Who pays the most money?
The other thing is, I don't think it's dead, man.
Can I ask you a question?
I don't think it's dead.
I don't think it's dead either. But can I ask you a question? In America, how do you ascribe control and ownership? Is it not always by who spends the most money on something? They have the most control and authority. Okay, Richard, who spends the most money?
Yeah, Fox and ESPN, yada, yada, yada.
Okay. All right. Just checking.
Also, there was good reporting, and I want to shout this in particular because good reporting on NIL deals and collective world is hard to come by. It's hard to come by. But a lot of different reporters working at The Athletic got some specifics about the Jaden Rashada fiasco that resulted in him breaking off the engagement with Florida and going to Arizona State. The deal was what had been described. You know, it was like $13 million that Florida didn't come up with the money. I wanted to share one takeaway from this, which is that I have never been more skeptical of a group of people than anyone who works for a collective or works in, you know, player acquisition for college football teams anywhere between Gainesville and Miami, Florida.
Wait, why?
No sympathetic figures here.
This is a
slimy business, man. There are some adult lawyers here who are quoted in the story who I'm listening to these guys being quoted on the record and like talking about their roles in these negotiations and in trying to get players for schools. And like, I wouldn't let these guys negotiate for someone to mow the lawn.
The last 2 years of college football's offseason has been installing glass windows, glass walls into the slaughterhouse, and nobody wants a cheeseburger now. Nothing's changed.
No, I think the one thing that has changed. Two things.
You can't say the amounts haven't made this.
He's right. The amounts have changed. And I think the second thing that has changed.
If we see six, 10, 20 more people commanding this dollar figure. And as of right now, I don't want to cut the segment off. I want to put a bow on Rashada as an outlier. And I don't think the market would disagree. But
it's a $14 million outlier. Like, it's not.
Also,
you know, it's yes, it is an outlier, but
we took a black market above the table and no one wanted to regulate it. And now we're still wagging our fingers at the process and the player.
No, there's no finger wagging at all.
Not we on this show.
I don't think anybody's.
Not we on the show.
No, I don't think anybody's wagging their finger at the player himself. I frankly feel quite bad for Jaden Rashada himself because I am quite sure he has gotten next to nothing out of this entire nexus of stuff, including his scholarship agreement with Arizona State. And I don't know if he's enrolled yet officially, but anyway,
you can do that online at ASU, baby.
Who
forks up. I might be a student at ASU.
Yeah. I understand that everybody wants to point at Florida's collective and say that is the nexus of the mess, which, yes, of course it is. But there is a lot more blame pie to go around with the people around Jaden Rashada, the people around Miami, the people like there was more than just Florida's collective in this massive fuck up, even though one can say, and I would agree with that, is the main head of the fuck up snake.
I'm going to get to Richard's
point, Godfrey.
Yes.
To Richard's point, the amounts are different. The second thing that's different, which Richard gets to there, is that there are a few more cooks in the kitchen with hands out that are serving as sort of intermediaries between where the money comes from and where the money goes to.
I don't know yet if that's true either, only because we never knew how many hands were involved in situations. Now, the dollar figures are bigger, but we all said the dollar figures needed to be bigger. I'm frustrated because... And I don't want to deviate on this because this week I'm going to do a solo show on this at splitsonduo.com about the kind of tail wagging the dog part about this, which is these sort of legally insane proclamations that are being made by the NCAA as to how they think they're going to enforce this. And you can hear me laughing as I say this because the statements made by John Duncan, who's the head of enforcement, are like literally not legally enforceable, and some of the most reprehensible characters involved in the NCAA, such as my old buddy Tom Mars, have even come out and said, like, yeah, this is insane. And so that's the end result. But again, causation, when we go back to the very beginning on this, and I'm trying to put a bow on it so we can just talk about football, is that they wanted look, NIL was an excuse not to create an actual payment system, and they didn't want to apply a single bit of regulation to it. When NIL debuted, Richard, you know this, people at individual universities, in compliance, in personnel, said, we don't know what's legal and what's not. We don't know who's
They're
in charge.
Still saying that.
Yes. And that is the fault of the system and the stakeholders. So I don't.
Schools.
I'm going to be honest, is there any shortage, a litany of shitbirds who are working as third party operators? Of course there are. That's what happens. It fills a vacuum. The stakeholders don't want to centralize authority because it would fundamentally change the definition of what the sport is. This is the same song we're singing with new verses. That's my problem.
Let's move to things that happened on the field. Like I've previewed, it is conference review season. We're going Midwestern this week. We will also, by the way, have a supplement to this conference review setup at splitsonduo.com. We've got a couple things coming for you on Patreon this week. We're going to do a mailbag that is Midwestern focused. That'll be up there at splitsonduo.com on Patreon later in the week. Start with the Big Ten. So we play Rose Bud Thorne. Rose, you loved it. Bud liked it. Curious for the future. Thorne didn't like it. I think everyone gets the roses here, and we have talked a lot lately about Ohio State and Michigan. Michigan's the rose, right? Like, congrats. You go undefeated until you meet TCU. You have a great year. The offseason has not started nearly that well, but it was a positive year. And Ohio State, hey, at least made the playoff and, you know, gets to continue to have anxiety about Ryan Day and do all of those things. Let's try to put the two big guys aside a little bit if we can. And with that in mind, Richard, I would like you to give me your non-Michigan, non-Ohio State rose in the Big Ten this year.
Well, I think me and Godfrey have the same one here.
Yep.
In that it was Illinois.
How could it not be?
Illinois. I mean, the other thing is they're in a lot of other ones in this league besides the big two that we stated.
The problem is there's so much oxygen that those two take up, but and we'll get to the whole like Michigan State and whether or not that's a problem or as big a problem. But we've lauded on last week's Patreon show, Richard and I were talking about the efficiency and just the good eye that Brett Bielema has had in terms of building the staff, replacing the staff. I've done my mea culpa on Bielema because he's just, I mean, at this point, a shadow of him for his former self being kind of like a punchline. But this is a competitive team. It has an identity. It's developing and recruiting talent better than I can remember since like Juice Williams Rose Bowl. They have a really good O-line. They have a really good defensive line returning. Luke Altmyer, the Ole Miss transfer, is going to do well in Barry Lunny's offense. So it's as much a bud as it is a rose, at least in the context of Illinois, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, the way they built it this season, and I don't think it's a house of cards because Ryan Walters is in the defensive staff or leaving. I don't think it's a house of like.
What no, about the fact that? No. What about the stack that they're at a rival school now, or at least a school in the same division?
Division's
going to be a lowercase word, you know. I don't worry that much about it in the context of Illinois. I really don't.
Yeah, I don't want to say the changes to the league are overstated because you're adding another big boy, but I do think I should probably be better about like using that as like a crutch for arguments or projections about the future. Yes, it's going to change things. They're not going to fold football in Illinois, Iowa, and Northwestern, even though maybe the latter should consider it.
Northwestern just folded offense. It's a very experimental sort of deal.
I do think Illinois, what they ran into with Chase Brown and that offensive line has it built on a solid foundation. Where do you go from there? For the love of God, do you have a quarterback? We'll find out.
We will find out. The loss of Chase Brown to the NFL will be acute. I loved watching him play football. He was one of my favorite college football players over the last 2 years. And we did love competent and then some Illinois. I like that as a rose pick. I'm going to go elsewhere in the Big Ten West. I might now suggest that the fourth most stable program in this conference is Minnesota. Question mark. How'd that happen?
Go on. I think this is contextualized too by the change in the division or the elimination of. So go on.
Yeah. So like things did get sort of towards the middle of the season off the tracks. Like they had been, as Richard and I talked about at length on various hurry ups, like Minnesota had played nobody with a capital N for the first 4 weeks or so of the season and was just destroying teams.
Statistical outlier.
Yeah. And then ran into problems when they started playing more serious competition. And, you know, that took some momentum out of things for them. But this is the third time in 4 years, and the only exception is 2020, which was a weird year, where they've won at least 9 games. They've won almost 30 games over the last 3, like, regular college football seasons. They're going to lose Tanner Morgan and Mo Ibrahim, who's one of the best running backs in the country for a while. I did check to make sure on both of those because – those are a couple of endless eligibility players. Also, Chris Ottman Bell, their receiver, endless eligibility player. He's playing his 7th year. He is coming back next year. So they're going to lose a bit. But they've just been steady, steady, steady. And here's the other thing. We don't – like over at splitsonduo.com, how many times did you talk about PJ Fleck for other jobs this year? Like 0 to 1, if that? Like it feels like he's just there. And it just seems like he might be just cool there after a number of years where people wondered if he was going to be, you know, an Oregon candidate or even a Notre Dame candidate at different points. And you know, kind of people were trying to rehome PJ Fleck with various.
I think he's settled in, to your point. Yeah, I think he's settled in and has not had a high end moment to get out of his reputation for better or worse. That's not the worst thing in the world, especially if you're Minnesota.
No, I mean, and he's just like done a pretty good job there on the field. All the stuff that we say about him whenever we talk about him is still true. Like he burns people out. He's not for everybody. It is totally possible that whenever that does meet its end, that it's not pretty, because most things in this sport meet a not pretty end. But I think, you know, we had gotten a couple questions about this. A patron, Josie, had asked us a couple questions about this. A few Minnesota fans had said things like, are we wrong to be feeling really good right now? And I don't think so. Like, I don't see a problem here. I think like before the year, I was kind of skeptical, and Richard was like, I think it's good in the neighborhood with Minnesota. And it's just weird to see sort of such an obvious middle-class Big Ten team be in such an apparently zen position.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Good for them.
I like that.
As we move to buds in the Big Ten Conference this year, things that we really, you know, liked and are optimistic about for the future that really showed some emergent qualities. This is another one where I'm going to kind of cheat the game, because I think the obvious answer to this one is Penn State. They showed everything except that they were able to hang with Ohio State and Michigan. They beat everybody else that they played. They won a Rose Bowl. They have a lot back. Drew Aller, the young five-star quarterback, is going to replace Sean Clifford next year. The two really good running backs, who are both freshmen, Nick Singleton and Catron Allen, are both going to be back. Abdul Carter, among other very good young defensive players, is going to be back on that defense. So great. Like, I think everyone sees that 2023 is a possible real up year for Penn State. I am curious about other buds, other things that you saw in the Big Ten this year that were not quite rose quality, but that genuinely uplifted you and that you think might be intriguing 23 and beyond.
Richard, you and I are both forward facing on this. And when I mean forward facing, I mean like
the rest of the league sucked.
Post carousel forward facing. So you can go first.
Yeah, I am. I got an eye on Nebraska. I got an eye.
All right. Are we creating a meme today? Are you doing Richard investment joke things?
No, because it's way too early to invest. It's way too early to invest.
I would agree.
But talk to a couple people over there. Understand a little bit about what Matt Rule's looking for with players.
You were incredulous about Matt Rule's stock in the market early on in the carousel.
In his ability to navigate the portal stuff, yada, yada, yada.
You specifically on the phone to me many times said, y'all love some Matt Rule, I believe was the exact quote. Do you love some Matt Rule, Richard?
Don't know.
All right.
Don't know. I got an eye on it. I got my eye on it.
So what makes you slightly fuzzy now instead of just indifferent or incredulous?
Well, I think
that you can say right now.
What Nebraska is looking to do scouting wise, I think from a player acquisition basis, I think is the thing that has me. All right. If you looked at what Matt did at Temple, at Baylor, let's shove the NFL out for a second. Okay. If you look at what Matt Rule did at Temple and at Baylor, one of what I do think he was had a masterstroke ability of is to say, for fuck's sake, that guy's got some measurables. We'll figure it out.
Best player available.
Like they just took Eric Gilbert, man, and God love him. I really hope that Eric Gilbert is in a great spot mentally to play this game at the level that I think he can play this game. If he's not, it's no shade to him. That's fine. I do hope Nebraska puts the support system around him that he needs. But that is a vestige of Matt saying that guy's measurables on paper are whew.
Right.
I want to give some supporting evidence to what Richard says about what they're doing with scouting and building the organization. Saw this in the Omaha World Herald over the weekend. Right now, I think Nebraska has a support staff, like non-on-field assistant coaching staff size of 39, which is tops in the Big Ten and only behind Texas with 40 nationally. So we've talked about this with in the context of Georgia and Alabama a lot. And like, if you have enough budget and you can just hire staff, especially as the lines apparently are going to break down between who can coach and who can't. There's benefit to just being rich in football or spending a ton of money on football. And if you deploy these people smartly, having a huge operation, Nebraska can have a huge operation under Matt Rhule.
Yeah. One thing that's never, like, Nebraska's got the money. Like, nobody's ever really said Nebraska's broke ass. Like, that's not the case. So, okay. I got an eye on it.
Okay.
Stephen Godfrey.
Equally having, I have two eyes on Luke Fickell in Wisconsin. And so let's start with the fact that Wisconsin modernized. Wisconsin did something that was outside of the Wisconsin identity as we know it from Barry Alvarez from sort of the beginning of creation on, and that they're going to look something different than like large offensive tackles who are going to take you to a 9 or 10 win season in which you get walloped by Ohio State or Michigan in the conference championship game. We're going to run off tackle. We're going to make some nice tight ends. It is what it is. I don't know if this is going to work. And I guess admiration and I respect the way that Luke Fickell turned maximize Cincinnati to it. I would say this. Cincinnati is defined as a G5, was maximized and turned into more of an efficient program than anyone has ever done with a G5 in history. And that includes Boise. That includes Central Florida. I don't know if that's controversial or not, but as I go through the clips early on, and it is way, way, and this is why I was kind of picking at Richard, because this is just way too early. We don't really know what the roster is. I've said on the Patreon shows before about just talking about being incredulous. My jaw's on the ground that he hired Phil Longo. Because even from a personnel standpoint, Wisconsin's just not there. They don't have that. Okay? But he's at alumni events already saying, you know what? We want to have an emphasis on the state of Wisconsin and recruiting Chicago, which is sort of like they sort of consider Wisconsin from a recruiting standpoint.
Yeah, I was gonna say, but you gotta put that one.
But
in
his state, but like his staff doesn't reflect any Wisconsin staff in history in terms of like the connections or sort of the obvious like form. Like it's big on former Badgers. Now my thing is like you had the former Badger. You had the guy that we were all convinced and several really intelligent people in the coaching and agent community were convinced was your guy, your defensive coordinator. You promoted him. You gave him the audition space. And then for whatever reason, and I'm not saying that in like a negative or flippant way, you went with like best coach available, which I give you credit for. I am fascinated that I think Fickell will be certainly different. And I think Wisconsin is modernizing. I have a couple questions in my pocket, but I do know this. When he went to Cincinnati, he was allergic to any kind of quick fix, and they took it in the teeth. I think they were 4-8 that first year. I wrote this in the notes, Alex. They're a bud long, long term. I do not think they will be relevant or even they will not portray the image that they're going for long term in 2023. This will be a transition year. He's not going to portal. He's not going to... Pause. He's not going to portal that way. So I'm saying all that with a bunch of caveats around it. Honestly, this is probably just an excuse for me to just kind of gawk at Wisconsin and what they've done because it's just very interesting.
So it's like not going to be a Michigan State under Mel Tucker for worse and for better, perhaps.
No, that's a good enough transition for us to get to Thorns, Alex, because let's go ahead and walk over here. Again,
you're skipping
that,
my bud.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, but then pause this conversation because how and when we use Michigan State, portal, I think has become like, okay. You know, if Ohio State and Michigan hadn't both made the playoff, I swear to God, this would be the most pressing thing that we talk about inside the Big Ten. So let's do your bud first.
Then let's just get to it. Then my bud is going to be Maryland because Talia Tagovailoa, for whatever reason, is coming back to my alma mater for 2023.
Don't skip the alma mater. Give it, do the love.
The schedule actually looks pretty easy as well for the most part. So let's take another crack. Let's try to get our 9-win season. I will eagerly await finding out what will get in the way of that. Richard and I will surely discuss it on a hurry up, probably around week 8 or 9 of next year. Love my optimistic outlook on my school's football team. But yeah, Godfrey,
I will say, Alex, and I've said this on the show, man, Maryland is the one where I'm like, the shoe is going to drop.
Yep.
Like the other shoe will always drop on Maryland.
It's going to drop. Yep. Typically happens. But they won 8 games this year. So, I mean, we'll take that. That's very good for us. And it was
Alex has just moved to 2 places ahead of me in the cynical alma mater competition. But that's OK.
I don't know. It's close.
I'll come back harder.
I don't know if I'll ever compete with you there. But Godfrey, let's talk. We're going to go to Thorns. I don't think anyone's saying Michigan State was like the worst thing in the league, but I did want to talk about them here because they didn't have a good year.
So when Alex sets up our run of show and kind of like starts a structure of notes and we go through and you wrote on Thorns, you just wrote in parentheses, got to hit Michigan State here. Now, then you dropped in a school that's not Michigan State, who, spoiler alert, I think everyone can figure out who it is. And then I just kind of sat with that as I was going over the notes this morning. I want to walk this out with you, Alex. They went 5-7. They were not what they were the previous year. But when I look at like the 5-7 Michigan State that I saw this year, and then you walk, then kind of jump backwards over the mountain that was Kenneth Walker and the portal success that they had upsetting Michigan, and go back to the post D'Antonio landscape. Are we not still on a discernible path towards progress in East Lansing?
Yeah, but I can look at that, dude. It's a 5-7 that is not terribly removed from being a 2-10, man. Like
Indiana at home.
Indiana
beat Illinois. Sorry. Go ahead.
I would not fault and don't think Michigan State fans are out of pocket for being, you know, pretty seriously worried about how last season specifically in Silo went. I think that's pretty fair.
Okay. They essentially disappeared on offense when the games got legitimate in early in the season. Now they did draw Washington in Seattle, which sucks because this was like resurgent brand new Washington year, Washington fun program, but we'll talk about another show. Invisible against Maryland, invisible against Minnesota, largely invisible. I think that scoring was done in cleanup time in the blowout with Ohio State. So I get what you're saying to a degree. But this was a team that was never going to be as good as the previous year. And I just feel weird about Thorn in a sense that maybe we're just punishing them for hitting blackjack like 10 times in a row in 2021.
I guess
this is more a working theory here. I'm going to embrace it being a thorn, Alex, but I just need one more data set. I feel like
the counter to that is that I hear what you're saying, but like what he inherited from D'Antonio was basically a 500 team. Like D'Antonio had gone stale. They'd gone 7-6.
Stylistically very different than what he wanted.
Right. But it's just, I think it would have been reasonable team, even if they had gone 6 wins or 7 wins in his first year, to be hoping for a little better in the second year.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm not suggesting that they do anything other than try to fix it. I'm not saying that at all. And also they can't because they gave him the deed to the school after 1 year when Big Ten teams were all doing that. So I'm just curious to see where they go. You'd still think long term they're the fourth best bet in that half of the Big Ten as long as it remains a half of the Big Ten. But work to do, and the distance between them and everybody else that they want to compete with got longer this year than it's been in a very, very long time.
And it does seem like we can put at least by the efforts made, not even necessarily by every guy they landed, but by the efforts made in recruiting that no, he's not Lane Kiffin. He doesn't want to be Lane Kiffin. He's not sitting here laughing at the end, like spitting in the face of the system and calling himself Portal King on Twitter. He's going out there and trying to reinvent Michigan State recruiting away from like, give me your Midwestern workman, like 2 and 3 stars from the Detroit area. Like he's going and trying to win the battles that you would expect someone with his resume at Alabama and Georgia to do.
Richard Johnson, thorn me.
Was the Big Ten West the worst? And I know we're kind of getting away from division, but was the Big Ten West the worst division in college football this year?
No, but it was less. It was maybe the least fun.
What are you taking? Some CUSA shit?
Yeah, I was about to say. Where are you going, Alex?
Where am I going?
Yeah, instead.
What's the worst division?
Yeah. Because I stopped there.
Honestly, by the end of it, the Sun Belt East was pretty not fun. By the end of it, You could probably pick either Conference USA division.
Alex, I'm gonna be honest with you. And I know I'm an idiot. Oh, but
the Mountain West West, where the Fresno State,
I was about to say
Fresno State. Yeah, they did just win the conference.
A thought experiment in November, with all those rosters being equal, give me Coastal, and even give me like a scoring allergic app, and like let them run through the Big Ten West, and let's see what happens.
The Mountain West West was almost won by San Jose, or almost ish won by San Jose State. It was a tough year in the Mountain West.
I'm gonna go bottom to top. Northwestern, need I say more? Nebraska, need I say more? Mm. Wisconsin, halfway through, fired the coach unexpectedly. Everybody thought they were gravy training into the interim, and then came out of nowhere and hired Luke Fickell. It ended with a rose, but that was not awesome in the beginning there. Minnesota, statistical anomaly for four games of the season, and then, you know, came crashing back down to earth. Illinois, fun, awesome. Iowa, we'll get to that in a second. And Purdue, who somehow rose above and won that half of the league. It was not awesome. It wasn't. By the way, Purdue, if I'm not mistaken, Purdue won this division. They played Penn State, but they avoided Michigan and avoided Ohio State in the regular season.
Yeah, they played.
And that's
almost beat Penn State in the opener.
Yes, almost beat Penn State in the opener, which was a Thursday night, if I recall correctly.
It was.
So, you know, it wasn't great. And that's the best I can say about the Big Ten West.
You know, really Northwestern should be the thorn. Pat Fitzgerald makes what I assume is quite a bit of money, probably $5-6 million. A game.
Don't take my flowers from me. We still have to talk about bad things.
You know what? So you know what my thorn is, because I talk about this a lot, but I've given myself a few months off of it ever since I blogged it out at slate.com about the absurdity of the situation midseason. But it's Iowa, and I'm not going to go through. These guys are going to laugh at how many notes I have on this situation. I'm going to not go through all of them. But as Richard reported on for Sports Illustrated and others noticed on Monday, Brian Ferentz remains as the offensive coordinator at Iowa. The headline here is that he basically gets an amended one-year contract that becomes a one-year contract, because most Iowa assistants are on rolling two-year contracts, becomes a one-year contract that automatically extends if Iowa hits 25 points per game. Now, Richard, a lot of people had a question about that 25 points per game target that Brian has to reach in 2023, because there was some fine print that people were wondering about. Do you want to share that with the program? And I want you to tell me verbatim what question you asked of Iowa's media relations people when you were reporting on this.
The question verbatim that was asked to the folks at Iowa was, are we just talking about offensive points here or all points? Because apparently all points matter, given that Iowa had 6 defensive touchdowns last season and 2 safeties. The 2 safeties are a big deal, because remember, the 2 safeties came in a game in which they won 7-3 against an FCS team.
FCS national champion, I will give them that, but still, you know,
but still,
like, come on, fellas.
Yes. Brian Ferentz is basically on a PIP. He's on a personal action plan. Either Iowa scores 25 points per game and makes a bowl game, and he gets reinstated to his prior salary and prior rolling two-year agreement, or the contract will expire next June, which basically means he will resign at the end of the season, is probably functionally how it will go, and or he will be rehomed to a different place.
Or name the next head coach, and that's where I'm betting my money.
Which is absurd, because they have 2 extremely qualified coordinators on that staff who would be fine head coaches, but maybe the timing of this, like announcing this in February, smells a lot to me like you tried to rehome him, you couldn't find him another job, and daddy wouldn't fire him. Like, that's probably I want to be technical. Gary Barta wouldn't fire him, because remember, Brian Ferentz reports to the athletic director in a totally legitimate arrangement that I'm sure reflects the absolute power structures within the athletic department. Anyway, I hate this. I hate this. I think the offense will be better next year. But all the reporting that Richard's done over the years about the various inequities in the coaching industry, and all of the ways that coaching is fucked up and that people, you know, don't get the opportunities they should, and it's not a fair playing field. Like, this guy's the one man advertisement for it. He would not have this job at any other program in the country if Daddy weren't the head coach. It's embarrassing that a public school is letting this happen. Gary Barta is a really, really bad college sports administrator. And I find it very striking that, like, Nick Saban could not get away with this at Alabama. I'm dead serious. He could hire his child if he wanted to. They would let him do that. And nobody was that upset when Iowa hired Brian Ferentz for OC. But Greg Byrne, the AD at Alabama, who's an actual professional, would not abide this 4 or 5 years down the line of a failed experiment. Why does Kirk Ferentz get to do that? I don't know.
No, Kirk Ferentz gets to do this because since Brian Ferentz has been the offensive coordinator, Iowa has gone 9-4, 10-3, 6-2 COVID, 10-4, and 8-5. Like, remember,
That is why he gets to do it.
Right. The offense wasn't good in the conventional ways that you, dear listener, think is good before Brian Ferentz. And it isn't, obviously, now. Mm-mm. But remember, and we stated this on the, we talked through this, me and Godfrey did, on the Patreon show that was last week. At the end of the day, Iowa's got a win-loss total that a lot of programs in Iowa Station and below would kill for in the last decade plus.
Yeah, I just reject the idea that they have to allow this to continue even so. Like, you ever watch an Iowa game on TV, you ever go to an Iowa game, like, it recruits itself. They pack a stadium every week. They have a great fan base. They have a lot of history. They have multiple world-class coordinators on their staff and some really good players too. And they settle for this because they feel like they have to. I just don't like it at all. Okay. Messy game of the year in the Big Ten. I'm going to go, well, you know, we already talked about Iowa, South Dakota State. That game had 21 punts. Iowa State, that game had Iowa losing despite blocking two punts, which actually did happen another time this year. They were not the only team to do that. I think, actually, in fact, I will get to the other team to do that when we're talking about the MAC in a little bit. But yeah, there were a lot to choose from. The Big Ten does not always play the most aesthetic brand of football.
Understatement of the year. Non-Iowa rules applied, since I knew Alex would be more than authoritative on that. Ohio State 21, Northwestern 7. Do you remember that, dear listener? You don't. I think maybe you just have a week in the gym where you didn't track your macros. So maybe all my bros at Ohio State, that was just the week that the Buckeyes were like, didn't get their sleep cycles in. I don't want to explain it. I don't need to explain it. It was a god-awful game. And also, anytime I talk about Northwestern, it just makes me want to talk about how terrible Nebraska was in hindsight. If you don't know what I'm talking about,
it was bad. It was
please
bad.
Pull up Northwestern's 2022 schedule, because I also want to tell somebody, look, if you're listening to this, the three of us don't watch every college football game. It's not possible. So if you
conscientiously avoiding a lot of the shit we're talking about today.
If you only saw week zero, because you were excited for the season and you were like, oh, it's Ireland and it's Northwestern and Nebraska, I want you to pull up Northwestern's schedule right now. All of us will wait. I want you to hit pause on the podcast. Okay. Now do you understand? Dude,
Godfrey, I remember, I think I said this, like, I know I said it on Split Zone Duo afterward. I was like, Nebraska lost that game to Northwestern. Yeah. But like, I think this might be a better Northwestern this year.
Man, well, I thought it was the worst.
That was the worst thing that was said on the show all year, was me saying that I think this might be a better Northwestern. Therefore, the loss wasn't that bad. We all miss sometimes, but yikes. Oh,
man. Yeah. I bought that too. Don't feel bad. I bought that too. So, Richard, wrong one. What do you have? Oh, God. Oh, God.
Well, yeah, maybe the Fiesta.
You're really mad at the West.
Well, I'm not really mad at the West. I'm really mad at Michigan as far as the Fiesta Bowl is concerned. The other thing is this. Where else are you grabbing a game of the year from?
No, we're talking about messy game of the year.
Richard, you're jumping ahead.
Yeah, you can leave it in.
Are you finding a messy game of the year from that's not Iowa and not Northwestern as a crutch?
I don't know.
You could have gone Nebraska Rutgers. Nebraska Rutgers was pretty rough this year. And I think that was when Rutgers might have fired their OC, was as a result of that game.
I don't know. Like, Purdue, Minnesota wasn't great. That was when Mo Ibrahim was out and Minnesota stopped being a statistical outlier, which, again, they were for like 4 or 5 weeks of the season. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There were a lot of turnovers in that game. It was pretty ugly.
All right. Actual game of the year. Richard, you've got the Fiesta. Godfrey, you've got the Peach. Yeah, I mean, that seems about right. Those were two pretty good games.
I think, yeah, just to speed this along, because everyone's very familiar with those games. It doesn't matter. Win-loss doesn't matter there. I think it's a display of your best element on the largest stage. I would lean towards the Peach as bias because you are a shanked field goal away from beating the best team in college football who went on to annihilate the last remaining playoff team. So, in terms of large-scale proof of concept, yes, it still solely resides within those two programs. Yes, they are wildly different in the style in which they accomplish this. Yes, we have already talked about the short and long-term trajectories based on the sitting head coaches there. However, proof is there. We saw those games happen. The Big Ten can acquit itself. It can develop and it can compete. Ohio State, by all rights, could have been in the championship game beating TCU.
Yeah. Sit on that one. That's tough. Not an easy one to hold.
Real weird.
Two for me here. The opening night, West Lafayette, Penn State 35, Purdue 31, where Penn State had to come back late, was a very good game. And in retrospect, like, Penn State surviving a weeknight in that stadium, kind of a feat.
Not a lot of people watched it, Alex, because it was coming. It was on, I think, FS1 while everyone was watching Backyard Brawl. And everyone was like super excited that Backyard Brawl was back. And that's great. And it was on ESPN. I think everyone rolled over at the end for the ending, but not a lot of people watched that game in its entirety, which is fine. That happens.
I was happy for Penn State that they were able to get out of Pitt's shadow by the end of that night. And
there it is.
You know, be seen, because I know it's sometimes tough for them. Ohio State 43, Maryland 30 was a good one, too. Maryland was actually in that game in the final minute of clock time, though there was like a calamitous touchdown the other way that made it 13 points. So there were some really good games in the Big Ten this year. SCD dude of the year. Blake Corum is a great pick here. I am cool with Blake Corum. I also like, he was just an exceptional college running back in every way for Michigan. And they did miss him even when Donovan Edwards ripped off some huge runs in both the Ohio State game and certainly the Big Ten championship game and the Fiesta Bowl. But I like outliers, and I wanted to note Nick Erbig, the Wisconsin linebacker who had 11 sacks in a conference where nobody else had more than 7.5. Bit of a feasting against cupcakes, but still led the league with 7 in conference play. Wisconsin, they just always have these dudes, always will.
Richard?
It's Marvin Harrison. It's embarrassing that the other two of you don't think it's Marvin
Harrison. No, you're right.
I just try and zag on these things because I just always want to talk about someone you may about.
I am curious about how much Heisman burn Marvin Harrison is going to get through next season, to be completely honest with you.
Kind of depends on who throws him the ball, doesn't it?
That's fair. However, you do know one of the quarterbacks that I think is probably the leader in the clubhouse for that starting job was his high school quarterback. They played the same high school team together.
Yeah.
It's Marvin Harrison. Watch this space. He's a fucking freak. He's going to be a top 5 pick.
Jerzon Johnny Newton, Illinois, returning defensive tackle, could possibly be the best defensive tackle in college football next year, and he's at Illinois. That's a true statement. Also, there was another guy on the team, too, that I think was eligible to go out who didn't. As an aside, as a Wobegon Falcons fan with a lot of cap room and a lot of draft picks, the NIL is affecting the NFL because a lot of these kids, I think more kids are sticking around. So, for that last season. Illinois can be good, y'all.
I should have mentioned Blake Corum is among those players sticking around. I'm not sure how much of that is that, how much of that is that he got hurt, but he's back and will be great for Michigan again.
Some of this has to deal with the running back class itself and his injury and that sort of stuff.
If you're interested in buying some extremely comfortable, extremely good-looking merchandise for just about any team in the Big Ten, you can do that at homefieldapparel.com. That's homefieldapparel.com. Homefield is our longest standing partner here and have been great friends to us for many years. Also makers of the best premium vintage officially licensed collegiate apparel on the market. If you haven't ordered anything from Homefield yet, you can use the code SZD20. That's SZD20. Get 20% off of your first order. And they always often have a lot of different fun promotions and different ways to save money. You can check those out if you just go to their website, homefieldapparel.com. a lot of different shirts, a lot of different ones of those in my closet and dresser, respectively. Also want to use this space to make a small announcement that if you are going to be in Indianapolis, Indiana, on Friday, March 3rd, from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. local time, that's Eastern time, we, the three of us, are planning to be in Indianapolis at Gugman House Brewing Company on Ghent Avenue. We are going to be there with Connor, the founder of Home Field Apparel, and just use it as an opportunity to meet some people who listen to the show, talk a little bit about football, talk a little bit about what we do here, and learn about you as well. We love meeting people who listen to the show. Always a bit shocking when you get to do it in real life, and we kind of move off the internet. So we endeavor to do more of that this year. If you are interested, we would love to have you. The details are actually on our Patreon page at splitzoneduo.com, but I'm unlocking it right now so that everybody can read it. There's a whole list of things there about, you know, when, where, parking, drink options, things of that nature. We would love to see you there. If you do want to go, and we'll tweet out a flyer too, please RSVP in the next couple of weeks before the event on March 3rd by emailing podcast@splitzoneduo.com with Indie RSVP and the number of people in your party in the subject line or the body of your email. Greatly appreciate it. Stephen Godfrey, you ready for some action? We've got more conference reviews.
All right, let's go. Am I starting this one off?
Yeah, please. Begin us with your rose.
Yeah, my rose is Eastern Michigan. We can now say that, hey, there's a sustainable model in old Ypsilanti. I didn't really mean to twang that word, but it's intimidating when you walk into pronouncing it on a podcast. This is legit one of the meanest teams in college football. I always hear that when I do my athlon gossip. They're like, oh, you don't want to play them. They're dirty. I take dirty as an accolade, as a superlative. 9 wins, beat Arizona State, won a bowl for the first time. Chris Creighton is an invisible miracle worker, invisible only because no one's noticing it. I would say that I don't know if I want to finish this thought. If you look at like why couldn't he do a Kansas? I guess is what I'm asking.
Would he
ever get the chance to do that? I don't know.
You mean like the get the Kansas job or pull
yeah,
a Kansas?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Agreement. Yeah, no, have a trajectory similar to, you know, he is a workmanlike guy. He came to EMU from Drake. If you're not from this part of the country, Eastern Michigan was one of the absolute, I mean, the Detroit Free Press called it the hardest job in FBS in 2015 or 2016. And the reason why is we've said this before, all MAC schools are not created equal. I did not know this, but I was doing some research yesterday. And did you all know that the gray turf was actually a play on the fact there are so many parking lots at EMU because it's a commuter school? So like Western and Central are like more college towns, I'm told. And EMU is like this place where you go, you're a student, you're probably in your late 20s or early 30s. You might have a kid. You're just trying to finish your degree in like a night school scenario. And people have said like, well, you know, they're not really a college culture. And they went in and embraced that and just became a nasty football team to play, for lack of a better term. I mean, there's no real sort of schematic genius at play here. But what they've done now is sustainable because I think this is either his fourth or fifth bowl. It's the first they've won. They didn't have a winning season for 19 years before he got there. So, yeah, I mean, this guy's probably should just be getting more attention regardless of the MAC, just at the FBS level in general.
Cosign. And I also wonder why we haven't seen more Chris Creighton looks. It's odd to me.
Kind of weird, right? Yeah. Like I'm not saying he's Lance Leipold. I'm just saying starting to look similar. Buffalo was a hard place to win at too.
Richard, I like your rose here quite a bit. I think that you have a good pick in the state of Ohio.
Yeah, man. I'm looking at them Cats, Bobcats, Ohio bouncing back from the Solich thing, ripping off. They won like 7 games in a row at one point this season. They were running them off. Obviously, the quarterback gets hurt late in the season, and it kind of derails what they had going on.
Curtis Rourke, best player in the MAC.
Yeah, I think that Rourke, first and foremost, is a like he's going to be a. We have talked about this as far as what the MAC and Maction needs. Maction, in my opinion, the easiest route one way to get people to care about what they do on Tuesday nights is to give draft Knicks, people care about the NFL, people care about football writ large, a quarterback to latch onto. And it could be this guy. Now, I know coming off a knee injury, I don't think he's terribly mobile. So, whatever. But coming off a knee injury, watch that space, of course. But yeah, man, pay attention to O'Rourke, pay attention to what Ohio has. I'm curious. They're a rose and a bud in that respect.
Yeah, kind of a family dynasty there at Ohio quarterback. His brother, Nathan O'Rourke, was quarterback there for a few years prior to Curtis taking the job. And he is really, really good. And as far as I can tell, though, I get bit by this all the time. By the way, most recently with North Carolina's offensive line, which I believe several of them are coming back. We talked about them last week. It's impossible to find out sometimes where eligibility lies and where people are coming back or are not coming back to school. Curtis Rourke definitely has eligibility left, and I've been able to find no indication that he's transferring or that he's going somewhere other than Ohio. So Ohio should have something to build on with this really, really good quarterback. And I think that given how bad things look like they could get there, where Solich retires right before the 21 season, and then they keep the interim and they do terribly, it looked like they could really lose the plot. And the fact that they did not kind of also has me thinking of Ohio as my rose in this conference. But we need to make space here to notice the actual winner of this conference, which is the Toledo Rockets. We probably talked more about Toledo per capita than most podcasts this year, because they're in an odd place where they had not won this league since 2017 under Jason Candle. They have the best infrastructure in the MAC. They are the best recruiting program, at least most consistent recruiting bet in the MAC, and had not been able to get it together. They, particularly the year prior, 2021, just had a horrible, horrible run in close games. That continued a bit at the beginning of this year. Remember, they had that game against San Diego State that came down to the wire that would have been a really nice win for them on the road in that scalding new stadium that San Diego State has. Didn't pull that out, but they did keep it together pretty well. Daquan Finn, their quarterback, was also hurt late in the year. So the MAC title game was a very injured QB kind of thing between Toledo and Ohio. But I think that's pretty much what you want to do is win the MAC when you're Toledo. And I sense that there was a lot of angst in that fan base before the year because of how long it had been, because of Jason Candle losing all these close games, also kind of flirting with Miami and that offensive coordinator job. Maybe that would have been better for Miami. Who knows? Before 2022. Flirting,
damn near taking.
It just didn't seem great, but he stayed and they won the MAC. And that is what, that's kind of where the gaze is fixed if you're Toledo. So you have to view that as a successful year. And, to some extent, you would think that would put some people at ease. I know that they have a new athletic director. Not new anymore, but new as in did not hire him. So I don't think it would have been great for him if they had stumbled again this year. But they didn't. They won the conference. Bud time, things that we liked, curious about. It's slim pickings here. I'll admit this. The MAC had a lot of tough teams this year, kind of like the American did, honestly, like we talked about last week. But Bowling Green made a bowl. Like, that's pretty huge. It does not happen frequently. It hadn't happened since the mid-aughts. And Scott Loeffler has been in that job for, Guffrey, take a guess, because I know you're a big fan of this coach. How many years Scott Loeffler has been the head coach now at Bowling Green?
This is either going into 23 would be the fifth? Is that right?
He's had a four-year run there. He's just settled in. They've gotten steadily better. If you discount 2020 when they didn't win a game because it was COVID, they've gone from 3 to 4 to 6 wins. And I don't know. The Falcons are improving. I think it takes a lot for Bowling Green to be good. It historically does not happen a whole lot. They did win 11.
It takes one of the better coaches of all time, effectively. Well,
here's the thing. They've had a few really good coaches there. If you want to go back to Urban, you can go back to Urban. But Dino Babers parlayed Bowling Green into the Syracuse job. Dave Clawson parlayed it into the Wake job before that. And both of those coaches won double-digit games. So, you can do it. It's just hard. And I think they did it. I don't know why I have such a memory of Bowling Green quarterbacks. But, remember Omar Jacobs, their quarterback in the 2000s? Early 2000s, mid 2000s, really good quarterback. They won with him. They won with Matt Johnson when Dino was there, and they had that Falcon Fast thing going on with Roger Lewis and Garrett Dieter, receiver who went on to Alabama. Again, I don't know why this all sticks in my head with Bowling Green, but point is, Bowling Green can have these ups, and I'm not predicting that Scott Loeffler is going to win 10 games at any point at Bowling Green. Godfrey is staring at the ceiling as I'm talking, Nice year, and happy for their fan base that they were able to go and be participants in a bowl game. They did lose that bowl game, that being the Quick Lane Bowl to New Mexico State, another team that doesn't make a lot of bowls, but it was trying a fun
to figure. I'm trying to figure out who's going to get you in the mentions first, if it's going to be Auburn or Virginia Tech fans, but you know, whoever does it, let me know.
Or Michigan,
my money's on Auburn. Akron is the definition of a bud. Yeah. Tiny bud. Joe Moorhead, the former Mississippi State head coach, OC at Penn State, OC at Oregon, has come in. They had a terrible season in terms of a record. They also had incredibly close one-score losses to a bunch of really good teams down the stretch. Buffalo, Eastern Michigan, Kent State, Central Michigan. I'm just rattling off, and then you go all the way back into Bowling Green, who we just talked about. They were a hard out and sort of figure to be better by virtue of Moorhead's resume alone and the fact they're stabilizing a roster that Tom Arth did not do the greatest job in the world managing. It will take time, but I would expect to see them somewhere floating around, jumping into that 500 nexus, which, again, context, Akron, one of the most have-not sort of programs in the MAC. If they are floating at 6 next year, then Moorhead could easily parlay that out and get another P5 head coaching job.
I mean, he's already trying to parlay it out right now. He is.
Whatever do you mean?
In discussions. He's had discussions with the Ravens about being their offensive coordinator. I don't think he's going to end up getting that job, but like,
no,
you know,
he's I know had several discussions Irish,
with the Ravens about being their offensive coordinator.
I know several Irish fans who would very much love for him to be working as a play caller in South Bend. So, but I do think ultimately he wants to be a head coach for obvious reasons. Just as an aside, since Richard brought it up, if you see someone in like stage 2.5 out of 10 in a program rebuild in the MAC bolt, we're not talking about Sean Lewis right now, who exhausted his options trying to get a head coaching job and then took a position coach or took a coordinator job for Dion. I'm talking about a guy who just is starting out in the MAC and he says, you know what, I'm going to go to this coordinator job. We really
good.
Buddy, we really got to talk about the MAC.
Okay, let's do it. Also, did Kent State miss the window when their head coach left to be an offensive coordinator for Dion at Colorado?
What window?
What?
Did Kent State have? I think Kent State had a window when they had a couple years of this really good offense and Dustin Crum until this year, before this year was quarterback.
It wasn't a window. I mean, you mean like, they didn't win the conference because they lost to Northern Illinois. But yeah, it's when we get to dudes of the year, I'll tell you why it's over.
Okay. Yeah.
Spoiler alert. But it's I'm going Buffalo on Buds. Buffalo, I think the technical term is a metric fuck ton of transfers that Mo Linguist brought in the first year there, and had some good returns. And so we'll see how they can continue to parlay that. I don't think they're not going to be probably Lance Leipold consistent. I mean, that was a 10 win, write it down every year program when Lance was there, but you could still have success there, at least peak it once or
upward
twice.
Upward trend.
Solid trajectory. Thorns in this conference
beat
this year.
Beat the brakes off of Georgia Southern in the second half of that bowl game.
They did, of the Kyle Ventrace Bowl. I think the thorn, I'm going to take NIU. Someone has to do it. This is the defending champion, the plurality preseason favorite in the media poll. But we do need to talk about context here. So back in 2021, they were on a magic carpet ride of one score games that went their way. They went 9-5 with a combined scoring margin of negative 21. Again, negative 21, 9-5. Talked a lot about that between last year and this season, how it's hard to make that stick. And it was hard to make that stick. They were 2-5 in one score games, 2-6 in games by 10 or less. They regressed a lot. They really only stuck at the one team all year. That was Eastern Michigan. But I think that they are the latest proof of how hard it is to stay up in this league, which will dovetail with something Godfrey might want to talk about that he just previewed. I don't know exactly where NIU goes from here. I think that they're probably just settle back into the middle class of this conference. But the good news is that while you can fall very quickly in the MAC, you can rise very quickly in the MAC as well. This was a case of the former, well, not the latter.
NIU has NIU expects to be the top of the MAC. And so if they average out and settle into being in the middle, then Hammock would be in trouble. So, I mean, they have every opportunity in front of them to make last year look like regression outlier or something like that. But I'm telling you now, it's like NIU is not content with sort of 7-win, you know, muddling about. They are a half, and they are.
Yeah, I think they're what? There's two halves in the MAC, really, Toledo and NIU. And maybe, I mean, Western probably wants to be at this point. Probably
yeah, Western and Central would argue that. And then, I don't know. Drawing that line exactly is hard, but it's easier to do on the high end and the low end.
Richard, Godfrey just mentioned Central Michigan. They also had a bad year after having a really good year under Jim McElwain. I guess that the Jim McElwain Power 5 Job Express train was derailed slightly this year. Can you be derailed slightly?
I'm pretty sure he got an extension. Am I right there, Godfrey?
I think so.
Maybe it was an auto raise, but I'm pretty sure he got an extension. It was not great into the season. It was not great going into the season Central. We'll see if they're going to get it. We'll see if there's a ship to be righted or if that was an early peak in the beginning of the McElwain era.
Godfrey, your thorn here is just sort of, as I look at our notes, sort of a general lack of enthusiasm right now about the Mid-American Conference.
This is not a cop-out. No. I don't do it. I've done it 2 years in a row now, and I'm still sort of sounding the klaxon. Also, I would have picked NIU as well, Alex. And so when you had NIU, I wanted to just go for my general complaint here, which is that Richard touched on this. I'm not like personally opposed to what Richard said. I don't know if I agree with the idea of like just turning it into NFL draft watch on a Wednesday night in November, but we got to do something here, guys. The rose is all the way off. The bloom is off the rose on any niche interest that casual viewers have in the MAC. We can debate this. We can talk about how we're not growing Ben Roethlisberger type Thursday night attractions the way we used to, or we can say it's the portal, or we can say it's NIL or whatever. But the reality is, like, those things aren't going away. And the MAC has done a really poor job in recent years of distinguishing itself in any way, shape, or form other than being sort of like Class C or Class D quality football. I accidentally did this where we have messy game and then game of the year. And I was trying to look for like those weeknight games that had some sort of oddball interest to them in like a narrative sense. And you could flip mine. I'm not saying there isn't quality football in this league sometimes, but I'm saying the two games I picked, you could say one was messy and one was the game of the year, depending on what you're looking for from the MAC, because that's how muddled I think the brand is right now.
Yeah, it's tough because it feels like we talk about this in this way kind of when we're taking stock of the MAC every year. And that's tough because it would be nice if it were currently a livelier, more charming part of the landscape. And it's hard when you're doing it in empty stadiums on weeknights for TV. It's hard. It's challenging. And I think that there's something where like that's cool for its college football Twitter presence, like MACtion being a thing and like kind of owning a night, but maybe not so cool for the actual lived experience of MAC football. For certainly fans, but also probably for players and coaches. So worth figuring out if you can. Messy game of the year here. The other team, other than Iowa this year, that had two blocked punts in a game this year that they blocked two punts and then lost, was Central Michigan. They did that against Toledo in week 5, and they lost 38-17. So I'm going with that one for my ugliest of the year.
That is just like, that's like impossible, man.
It's tough. It's tough. Although Central Michigan and Iowa doing it.
So this is where I get into like, was this a good fun game to watch or was this just a bad fun game to watch? 4-win teams, Western and Central Michigan, playing in the snow in a 12-10 final that saw 8 combined points in the second half. Is that a good fun? I don't know. Like, I mean, that's a crappy game. Although I do feel like it's like college football Twitter law that if there's snow on the field, it's like instantly fun and watchable. But I'm going to be honest with you. I watched part of this game and either am I getting old? Am I aging out of the niche quality here? Like, it wasn't that fun to watch. Like, it's I don't know. I feel like when I get into this Mac branding rant, it inspires a lot of existential self-examination. So that's my messy game of the year.
Can't put lipstick on a pig. My messy game of the year dovetails with Alex's actual game of the year in the, you know, was it good or wasn't it? The Bowling Green Toledo game late in the season. It was November in the season. Tough. Mostly the ending is where I derive the mess from, to be honest with you. The late pass over the top, shambolic defensive performance on that play. That's more or less where I get the messy moniker from.
That is my game of the year actual. It was the Bowling Green bowl eligibility clincher. They were 15 point dogs. It was snowing. The game comes down. It's this snowy night at the Glass Bowl. Toledo up a point in the last minute. Bowling Green gets a 42 yard catch and run to Teron Keith from Matt McDonald. And it was some of the worst tackling that you will ever see at this level. It was really tough, but it was sort of a beautiful mess. And there was snow on the ground to kind of give everyone a break because it's hard to plant and cut and make athletic movements on snow. It mattered, you know, and ultimately everyone can laugh about it. Even Toledo probably isn't laughing about it still, but Toledo did go on a couple weeks later to win the MAC. So all was okay. All was reasonably forgiven. And it was a good game. I like your game of the year here because it covers two fairly anonymous teams that don't get talked about a lot. And that I realize we haven't talked about at all on the show.
So I'm not trying to lean on the crutch all the time, but I do feel like it's my job to take narrative and to use it to get people interested in parts of the sport they might not be. So on a Tuesday night, the last week of the regular season, Miami beats Ball State 18-17. You can call it the Bird Bowl, I guess. Like, it was essentially an elimination game to who was going to go to a bowl game. So if you didn't see it, it wasn't like with time expiring, but it was under 2 minutes. Avion Smith throws a 34-yard touchdown pass, kind of like a basket fade, to Miles Marshall to win the game. Not high scoring, not the kind of action that you're used to, but that puts Miami in the Bahamas Bowl and knocks Ball State out of bowl eligibility. So with all those things stacked up, you would think that's kind of what you're looking for on those weeknight action games. It had all of those elements where it has the thrilling play that circulates on social media. It has the clearly defined stakes of going to a bowl. Like, that's usually outside of the MAC championship race as we get, you know, into November. That's kind of what we're looking for, right?
I would say so. Good pick. Richard, game of the year in the MAC for you?
Actual game of the year. I'm going to take an Eastern Kentucky Bowling Green in the however many overtime belter that was at the end of the year. At the beginning of the year, I should say. if you'll remember, Eastern ran a like hilarious like hook and lateral to a lineman that didn't work and ended up being very funny because they won the game. It's one of those things where you get into kind of 2 point a palooza there and you like run out of plays. That was a fun game. It was fun to have that FCS team upset an FBS team at that moment. It was a great start to Eastern Kentucky and an Eastern Kentucky team that really needed that start because their head coach basically died in his office like 3 weeks before.
And was brought back, and we are happy that he was.
I should have probably ended with that. Yes,
to be clear,
it has been brought back. I spoke to him a couple weeks ago.
Let's do the third act of that story, Richard.
Yeah, sometimes you got to finish the story. You can't just leave it there. Every podcast is somebody's first. SCD Dudes of the Year, you guys first. I'll close this out.
I cheated a little bit, and I just wanted to go Kent State Receiving Corps, RIP, because obviously with Sean Lewis moving on, y'all. I almost for the game of the year did the same sort of shtick that I did with the whole Mac, or sorry, with the Big Ten, of just saying like, here's Ohio State against Georgia, against the best, almost beating them. Off the top of your head, guys, does anyone remember the Georgia Kent State game? Anybody remember the score? 39-22. I mean,
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yes, it was.
Kent State scored 22 like, points, y'all. Like, I don't know why Sean Lewis couldn't get a damn job. Like, Sean Lewis's offense works. It really freaking works, man. When you can do that with that personnel against Georgia's defense in Athens, come on. So, wide receivers Dante Cephas and Devontez Walker were basically the team leaders in most of the statistical yardage. They are both gone. So I'm also giving you sort of a who to watch for. Dante Cephas is going to Penn State, where he will be a factor on a very good team. And also Devontez Walker is going back to his home state of North Carolina to play for the Heels. So kind of a silver lining, kind of a good story for them in that, like, Sean Lewis exhausts his options. He didn't really bolt so much as he just said, hey, like, I got to go take this Colorado job because I can't move up. But the team and the talent he assembled, they get to go play for contenders as well.
Yeah, it's tough. Richard, I think you have signaled that our Canadian great hope, the quarterback for the Ohio Bobcats, will be your SCD dude of the year.
Yeah, Mountie, baby. Rourke. Rourke's the guy. I'm really excited. Really excited to see how that plays out this season for Ohio.
I want to go back to Ypsilanti to close out this episode. My dude of the year, Jose Ramirez, Eastern Michigan edge defender. This guy was a terror this season. 12 sacks, two of those strip sacks. Also forced a couple of picks directly off whacking QBs and speeding them up. Game-changing player for, again, a 9-win EMU team. And had his best success against other directional Michigans. 4 sacks against Western, 3 sacks against Central, 19.5 TFLs total was the max defensive MVP. He is going through the Sunday process right now. Just played in the Shrine Bowl. He has a combine invite. Maybe he'll come to our event. I don't know. The one we're having in Indy around that time. But I hope that he catches on. We love it when a MAC defensive player catches on in the NFL and goes on to great Sunday glory. Also, we don't have that many people who play football on national TV on Tuesdays, on Wednesdays, on Saturdays, and on Sundays. And in the NFL, you could add Thursdays. This guy could be a day of the week king for high level football. Let's make it happen.
There you go.